Nicely with Martin Besser.
We've had this guest on the show a number of times. I always find it quite compelling, the kind of work that that he does and that they do. Professor Gerard, we're talking about his book, The Profiler Diaries, and we'll get to Profiler Diaries 2 in a moment. But in the book, you get to know a lot about the police, the South African police services over the last decade or two, and how things have changed. What I find interesting is that, was it in 2006, Jackie Celebi changed quite a lot of things when it comes to the specialized units.
What was it called?
The specialized crime.
Yeah, yeah. Serious and violent crime unity shut down. The sexual offences unity shut down, and
why?
A bunch of other units. Well, I think if you look what happened later, I think the intention was to sabotage our ability to effectively investigate definitely certain types of crimes, and I think the other ones just became collateral damage because he couldn't make it look like he was focusing on one type of crime. Organized crime, for example. So I think that was probably the most destructive act that's taken place in the modern history of the SAPS. Because what happened is a lot of those really great serious and violent crime detectives working on these specialized high-profile cases were now just sprinkled around in various police stations. And a lot of them resigned. They went to work for private sector. And we lost the exodus of people to the private sector because of that.
That's so shocking. So it was a selfish act.
I think
that cost our country.
Yeah.
I mean,
and still does.
It was a political act.
Yeah.
How critical are you of the police services now?
I don't want to be, because I don't like to be a negative person. I think when I was in SAPS, I always tried to remain very positive. But it's really getting difficult not to be critical. And it's not critical for the sake of being critical. It's because if we don't comment on these things, we allow them to continue in the way that they are going. So I think the criticism comes from a place of hopefully it'll make things get better, not just let's be critical. Because it's easy just to be critical in South Africa about everything. And you get people who are like that. And, you know, hopefully they all emigrate and the ones who are positive stay behind. But, yeah, so it is difficult not to be, unfortunately.
Is it harder for us to catch murderers these days?
I think so. I think in general, our ability to solve crime and effectively prosecute crime has dropped over the past, I think quite a bit over the past 6 or 7 years. And it was on a bit of a decline before that. But just as if the past, since 2016, things have really just gotten bad. You know, if I speak to, I still do some work with prosecutors and they say that the quality of dockets that they get after someone's been arrested, it's just on a shambles.
We hear that so often in the news. We hear that so often. Dockets are lost or damaged or can't stand up in court.
Mm.
So is it a case of laziness? Is it a case of bad management? Is it a case of training?
I would say the key element, it's probably all of that, but I would say the key element is if you don't have effective supervision on that low management level, like the captain who's in charge of 10 detectives, who's supposed to review every docket that these detectives are working on and give guidance. You know, they go through and say, do this, do this, do this. And that detective is supposed to go out and do it. And that's how the detective learns. I should do this. I did this in the previous case. That helped me. And after a while, a good detective presents a docket to his commander that doesn't really end up having many instructions because this guy is really top notch or she's really top notch. So if you destroy that sort of warrant officer captain level of experience, knowledge, you don't have people who become groomed into becoming amazing detectives. No matter how much potential you have, you're not getting that. Because going, as you know, you can go on a course for anything, but at the end of that course does not mean you can actually do the job. And it's the same thing with a detective course. You've got a detective course, which is now maybe 6 weeks, 3 months, however long it is now. You've learnt to be a detective, but you aren't yet a detective.
Yeah,
and that comes from being mentored by a really great person. And I think we've really damaged that level of experienced people, whether you're a uniform guy with a similar mentor or a detective, that's the problem.
So it's not necessarily about the basic training. It's about applying it. It's about just the passion for it.
Look, I do think that, I think the basic is fine, you know, and the crime scene training is pretty good. I do think things could be improved, but I think overall the training that they get is actually not bad. It's again what happens afterwards and what are you taught. If you have a lazy guy who's your mentor, you're going to learn to do things the lazy way too.
Yeah,
simple as that.
So a fascinating part of the books, or first book specifically, is your 14 and a half years in the South African police services, ending up being a brigadier, the investigative psychology unit, studying and being involved in solving cases, meeting the perpetrators, not only in jail, But I suppose when you're standing in front of an alleged murderer, things get real, right?
Yeah.
It's a whole different story.
Yeah, look, I mean,
you're nervous sometimes.
You know, even when I was doing my studies, my master's dissertation was on interviewing serial murderers in prison.
Yeah.
And that was one little bit of exposure. But that's, you know, those are guys in a very safe environment. They've been convicted.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're having to interview them to try and either get them to confess or to tell you something that they've done or whatever it may be, that's like a very different ball game. And you're not even yet sure, is this really the offender? You know, the evidence has led us there, but there still may be a question. Mm. And that's very different to interviewing someone who's, you know, been in prison for 5 years, 10 years, different environment. And you learn quickly. And I was very fortunate that when I joined, I got to work with really great people.
Yeah.
And that was my learning experience. Because, you know, being a psychologist didn't prepare me to be a profiler. I mean, in fact, throughout the world, the very few profilers are psychologists. They're typically people with investigation background.
Sure.
Who then went into this field and learned a little bit about psychology, a little bit about a various range of topics. So it's actually quite unique to be a psychologist and be a profiler. Yeah.
So your work takes you all over the country. Took you all over the country and still does, I suppose. In the Profiler Diaries, as I said before, a lot of those cases kind of stood out for me because they are places that you can relate to. You can picture the Bryanston complex, and as I said, the Centurion case. What was it, De Silva?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, the place where he stayed there by Supersport Park, where he dropped the body off on the side of the freeway. You can all picture it.
Highway.
In book two, Profile Diaries 2, it takes you a bit further. Port Elizabeth, Knysna, the rest of the country.
As far as Krugersdorp.
As far as so far as Krugersdorp. Of all those places, which place? I must phrase this very carefully now. You spoke about weird crimes. What was the weirdest scenario?
The weird stuff always happens in the little tiny towns.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it?
That you always think are
Doesn't
so
yeah.
conservative and nothing weird happens. But I mean, Velkom, I don't know, it's still a big town in the Free State, but I suppose for us in the city, a big city, it seems like a small little town. I mean,
Did
there
it
you
get
had,
weird? Did it get
that's
strange?
Where you had that couple that lured the Michael von Eck to a graveyard, cut him up, took the body parts home, skinned the face off, kept them in the fridge, and were planning to do that again. Was Velkom.
Right. Cool.
You get little, I mean, poor father, we had that case where that lady killed her husband who was a...
Before you continue, I must just quickly say that we are going to get into detail now that may be sensitive for sensitive listeners. Okay. We do have Professor Gerard who's talking about the Profiler Diaries. We're talking here about murders. We're talking about serial murderers. We're talking about hardcore crime. Some really weird crimes as well in South Africa. So just a heads up, poor father, yes, go.
So yes, I wasn't directly involved in that, but you had, you know, there was a hotel in Poor Father, and a couple owned it, and the wife organized someone to kill her husband.
Yes.
But I mean, cases like Springbok. I mean, I've had serial murders in Springbok, Vredendal. I mean, the youngest serial murderer I worked on who was, I think, 16 or 15 at the time he started, he was in Vredendal.
The vineyard story.
Yeah.
Did you read that part? The vineyard. And that was a failure of our justice system at the time, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So because he was so young, he had the first rape and murder. He was sent to one of these sort of, I guess you could call reform school.
Yeah. Right.
But they get to go home on holidays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a December holiday, a couple of years later, he ends up, you know, killing another person and attempting with someone else to rape and kill another individual.
They go home on holidays.
Well, you know, as any good serial offender.
And he got sentenced to 5-6 years for that second one.
That's
they,
all.
They convicted him on a culpable homicide, which I don't know how that
culpable
is possible because
homicide.
That's a negligent killing of someone. Like a car accident is typically a culpable homicide.
Can I also just tell you, this is what I also find fascinating about your books is that you explain things like that. The difference, the reason why we can't call it serial killers, because you know people call them serial killers.
Yes.
They're not serial killers, they're serial murderers.
Yeah.
Because you can kill someone accidentally.
Yeah.
Yes. Or legally.
Or
self-defense.
Legally. Self-defense.
Mm-hmm. You know, police, military, when they're fighting a war, you're killing people.
You can't literally be a serial killer because that would imply that you like really unlucky person. I mean, you've killed like 3 or 4 people out of self-defense. It's going to start looking suspicious. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you do explain things like this in your book.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a little legal technical. Yeah.
No,
most people will never change people from using the term serial killer.
Yeah. No,
sounds better, but technically, serial murderer, because murder is always an unlawful act.
Here's a question that came in for you.
My question for the professor is, which case affected you the most?
Which case affected you most?
Sure.
You know, psychologically,
all,
I guess.
They all affect you in different ways. And I think it's more the cumulative effect of all the cases and the frustration that you face in the workplace, like any workplace has, that really put the pressure on. But I think ones that I definitely always felt I really want to see this guy put behind bars was the case of Andrea Fenter, which I referred to, I think, in book one and two. Mm. And he was actually after, I mean, he killed Andrea Fenter, who
von
was...
Von Fieren.
Gerrit Janssen von Fieren killed her in a... May 2011.
Mm.
As she fled her flat to the entrance of Sabaya Sands, where she stayed in four ways. Sorry to anybody who stays in Sabaya Sands.
Right now.
Stabs her 14 times, cuts her throat in front of a bunch of witnesses, and
yeah.
then cuts his own throat and lies down in a sort of suicide attempt next to her. Then, you know, he somehow gets bail after we opposed it successfully, appeals it in the high court. Then he was supposed to go on trial 2013, he disappears. And I get information, eventually we track him down in Brazil. He's arrested six months later in Brazil. They insist he serves his time in Brazil for being in the country illegally. And then one day in 2016, I just left the police. We get called to Durko's head office in Pretoria, and the Brazilian embassy is there. They say, very embarrassed, sorry, he's been accidentally released.
What?
So from pretty much 2016 until 2020, just after COVID start, we tracked him down again.
Wow.
And he was extradited and convicted about... he was sentenced on the 5th of August. So, and that, I always felt it so unfair, because even before her death, she had taken out protection orders. That she would contact the police wouldn't go and arrest him. So he was let down in life and in death by the justice system. And I always thought this is, and this guy just didn't accept responsibility. He even still blames her for the fact that he killed her. And tried all tricks at court to sort of say it was a disorder that caused him to do it. And I just felt that's so unfair. And I want to see this guy face justice.
It bothered you.
Yeah, really did bother
me. You know what I find chilling about that specific case, and you describe it in your books, is that scene at the, was it like at the guardhouse there at the front by the complex, by that complex, where she laid after he stabbed her multiple times. Mm. Then he... he cut himself, laid next to her.
Yeah.
And the chilling part for me, and the way you describe it in the book, is the paramedics could save him, but not her.
Not her.
Mm.
Yeah.
And in that moment, you got to check yourself.
That's so unfair.
Right? Yeah. I was like, no.
Yeah. And in fairness, I said to the paramedic, I interviewed him as part of what I was doing in that particular investigation. Yeah. And I sort of tongue in cheek says, why did you let him live, you know? And he said, you know, when I get there, I don't know what the story is.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
And you shouldn't.
You know, was this, and that you can't. Yeah. So, I mean, and that's true. His job is to save lives. And I do feel, I don't know, I think a lot of people would say it'd be better if he died. I don't know. I feel, I don't know. I think he should face justice.
Absolutely.
And, you know, living in prison sometimes I think is a fate worse than death if you get a long sentence.
What is his sentence?
So he was sentenced to life imprisonment. You know, there was a condition in the extradition that the NPA wouldn't ask for longer than 30 years. But that doesn't mean the judge can't give longer than 30. And the judge highlighted that. He says, you guys, and the NPA didn't. The Berlin Bester, the prosecutor, was brilliant. She said, well, you know, we're bound to only asking for not more than 30. So we're going to ask for 29 years and a few months. And the judge said, well, you know, the extradition says we won't, that you won't request more from me, but it doesn't bind me to not give more. And he gave a life sentence.
Is a life sentence literally for life, or is it only 25 years and then you're up for parole?
Good question, Felicity. We often get that. A lot of people, even prosecutors, think life is only 25 years. And life is hangs over your head till you die. The question is, at a period of when you are eligible for a parole, which with a life sentence is 25 years, you might get parole. If you meet the requirements and you continue to serve that life sentence in the community with restrictions over your head, what you can and cannot do. If you mess up those restrictions, you pop right back into prison and you continue serving that sentence in prison until you maybe or maybe not get parole again. So the sentence hangs over your head forever till you die, but you might at some point be eligible to serve part of it back in the community.
Gotcha.
At our expense. 10 to 8. I've got to check myself. We could talk the entire show without playing any music, and I really shouldn't. But it is about the Profile Diaries. The second book is also out now.
About three or four weeks ago.
The Profile Diaries 2.
Very creative.
Which, yes. You took your time thinking about that title. And it's as compelling, if not more, than the first one. So if you enjoyed the first book, you got to get your hands on the second one. We'll talk some more coming up about the second one more specifically. Professor Gerard on the show this morning. Any questions? 084 850 0942.
With Martin Bester.